The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, entitled The Wisdom of Shimon ben Shetach and Yehuda ben Tabai, Creating a Just Society, is dedicated to the memory in Le'ilui Nishmos, all of the Kedoshim, the martyrs who were Moser Nefesh, who gave up their lives in defense of Achenu b'nei Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael. Yehei Zichron Baruch. Throughout this series, we have pointed out how the eternal teachings of Torah that are encapsulated within the dictums recorded in Pirkei Avos are also a lens with which to view and study the life and times of the sages who author them. There's no greater illustration of this principle than the Mishnayos that we will be studying tonight. Let me first read the Mishnahs 8 and 9 on the first chapter of Pirkei Avos. Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach kiblu mehen. Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach received the oral tradition from their teachers, Yeshua ben Prachi and Nita Rav Bailey. Yehuda ben Tabai said, Al tas atzmecho ke'orchei hadayonim, which is translated alternately, do not play the part of an advocate, or alternately, don't play the part of a secular judge. And we're going to see as we're going on what this means. And it continues on, while the parties in lawsuit are standing before you, you should view both of them as they were guilty, like evil people. Because when you're going through the interrogation process and you're listening to the claims and counterclaims, you should feel that, look at them or pretend that both of them are lying. Both of them want to receive something that they're not entitled to. And if you have that attitude, that critical attitude, you'll take apart their statements. If you come naturally with a bias, well, they're fine people, they must be telling the truth, you won't, have the sensitivity to read between the lines and to find perhaps subtle contradictions in their statements. When they leave your presence, after they've submitted to the judgment, you should view them as being guiltless. Because after they're finished, they've accepted what you said, you shouldn't go and think, about their past. Assume that either it was through error or they did tshuva, they've repented. At this point on, you should look at them as normative, regular citizens. But while you're in the midst of the process, Yehuda ben Tabai tells the judge, think the worst of them. Because if you think the worst of them, you'll be able, perhaps if they are lying, you'll be able to catch the misinformation that they're giving you. That's the statement of Yehuda ben Tabai. Shimon ben Shetach said, be thorough in the interrogation of witnesses. And have marbe lachkor seidim. And be careful with the words you choose, lest they learn from the way you express yourself to make false statements. This is how you shouldn't give leading statements. It shouldn't be evident what answer you expect from them. It should be carefully worded, your questions, so in order to trip them up. Not that they should be leading questions and really they'll understand what the right answer should be. As you notice, unlike most of the teachings that we have previously studied, which have broad application, the focus here is very narrow and directed solely to judges, providing them with guidance in dealing with litigants and witnesses. Why didn't Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach feel that these teachings, above all else, needed to be stressed? To truly understand what prompted them to concentrate solely on the judiciary, we must first study the tremendous political and religious upheavals that occurred during their lifetimes, especially with regards to the judiciary. We've covered in the previous lecture the story of Yochanan Kohen Gadol, Yochanan Hyrcanus, the high priest, who became a Sadducee later in life, and outlawed the practices prescribed by the oral tradition, the Torah Shebaal Peh, and attacked the Rabbonim who taught and practiced them. As a result, there was a wholesale slaughter of the Pharisees, the rabbinic scholars. In the words of the Gemara Kedushin 66a, the world was desolate until Shimon ben Shetach came and restored the Torah to its pristine glory. After Yochanan Hyrcanus' death in the year 104 before the Common Era, he was succeeded by his eldest son, Aristobulus. In order to cement his position, Aristobulus killed his own mother, as well as his oldest brother, Antigonus, and imprisoned his other three brothers. After his death, after only a year in office, his widow Salome, or Sholem Tzion, the sister of Shimon ben Shetach, released them from prison and appointed the oldest brother, Alexander Yanai, who took her as a wife through Yibum, the levirate marriage, as king. In other words, she freed this Yanai, who was the oldest remaining of the three brothers. Salome Shlom Tzion was the wife of Aristobulus, who had been a king for a year. He died. They had no children. And naturally, there's a halacha that if she's left without children, a remaining brother takes over the marriage. He has the right either to take over the marriage or dissolve the marriage through the ritual of chalitza, taking off the shoe. He performed the rite of Yibum. It would seem, because she was the wife of the deceased king, if she had been like-minded like her deceased husband, she would have killed out the rest of the brothers. But she did not. She was Shimon ben Shetach's sister. She actually released them. Yanai was the one who performed, the oldest of the remaining brothers, performed Yibum, the levirate marriage. Although Yanai was just a corrupt Sadducee as his father and brother, Aristobulus, as soon as he obtained the throne, he killed one of his other brothers. His wife, though, had some influence over him, and it is through her that Shimon ben Shetach, her brother, was able in some measure to restore traditional observance. After Yochanan Hyrcanus had banned the Pharisees and their teachings, he found himself without a judiciary. Basically, he killed all the judges. Because the Pharisees, being the scholarly class of the country, had been the sole judges. So Yochanan had to create a whole new judiciary consisting solely of his Sadducee colleagues. They, of course, were amaratzim, were totally ignorant of the Torah, and to be provided with a specially made guidebook called Sefer Gzeirosa, the Book of Decrees, to enable them to issue legal rulings. In all probability, it must have been compiled by some surviving Pharisee, some surviving judge, who put together this work. So even though they weren't versed in the Torah, they knew under this circumstance, this is the law. This circumstance, this is the law. Eventually, Shimon ben Shetach was able to expose their ignorance and to disqualify them from serving as judges. The 14th of Tammuz, the day he retired these judges and banned the use of the Sefer Gzeirosa, the Book of Decrees, was made into a national holiday. The historical background of this holiday, together with numerous other minor holidays, was preserved in a special work which was composed towards the end of the Second Temple period, called Megillas Tinus, the scroll of the fast days. Actually, it's a scroll of days in which it is forbidden to fast. This is a record of the minor miracles that occurred throughout the Second Temple period and the official observances which were mandated for those days. On some of those days, eulogies were forbidden, and on all of those days, it was forbidden to fast, as we said. This is how the Megillas Tinus described what happened. It's written, on the 14th of Tammuz, the Book of Decrees was removed and that day is forbidden in eulogies. As it's a real day of Simcha. As we said before, not all of the days listed in this Megillas Tinus prohibit eulogies. Some only prohibit fasting, but you could still deliver a eulogy. A day that they felt it was distressed, the additional joyous aspect of the day, they forbade eulogies as well. This was one of those days. The Sadducees, it continues on, had this book written and set aside, but they probably had it, they used, you know, these were dealing with every day, they had some old judge, you know, who helped them write this, I would assume. It contained a list of the crimes that deserve stoning, those that deserve burning, those that deserve beheading, and those that deserve strangling. When they would issue a legal decision, they would send someone to check this book of decrees, because they didn't know the law. When they were asked as to the scriptural source of the decision, they were unable to reply. They just knew that this was the way it always was done. In addition, besides that shortcoming, the Baisusim, you know, we speak about Sadducees, Tzedukim, and Baisusim. It would seem that these Baisusim, different than the Tzedukim, were religious people. And they've always, they had their own interpretation of Scripture. It seems generally Sadducees did not. Because Sadducees weren't religious people at all. Baisusim were religious people, but did not follow the oral tradition. And it would seem that Chazal, you know, the Talmud speaks of three groups. The Purushim, the Pharisees, the Tzedukim, the Sadducees, and the Baisusim. Josephus speaks of three groups, the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes. The Essenes had their own secret doctrine. Many of them were celibate. They constantly immersed themselves in the mikveh. They were an ascetic sect, but did not follow normative, traditional Jewish practice. It would seem to be that there seems to be a connection between these Baisusim and the Essenes. Josephus doesn't mention any Baisusim. And he says, the Baisusim would interpret the verse, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, to mean that if someone knocked out a tooth of his friend, then his tooth should be knocked out. If he blinded the eye of a friend, then his eye should be blinded, in order that they should be equal. So this, again, of course, does not go with Jewish tradition. The shortcoming of the Sefer Gezeirosa was simply not that it was wrong, it was just very limited. I mean, cases are not just by the book. You have to know the reasoning behind it. Every case is a little bit different. There were other problems, though, that they really interpret things away from traditional understanding. And it gives another example. They interpret the verse. This is a question about this is Torah speaks about. This is in Parshas Kisetse. This is in Deuteronomy 22:17. The case of a woman right shortly after they get married, he claims that the woman was not a virgin. The traditional understanding is, it's said in very subtle ways, that they actually he brings witnesses to support the fact that this woman had an affair, not before they were married, which would not render her, or not, there's no death penalty for that. But really, while in the interim between the Kiddushin, when they were given what we give today, the ring, and the chuppah, which at that time could last a year. By us, it's done all at once. So the Torah really, in subtle terms, is really describing a woman who has really committed adultery, and there are witnesses to say this. The Torah doesn't say it in so many words. And the term used, the expression is, force was a similar, they should spread the cloth before the elders of the city. Spreading the cloth means, according to our tradition, is really was an expression, that was not to be understood in its literal sense. It's just like we have expressions of burning the candle at both ends, which means that you're overworking yourself and you're depriving yourself. It does not mean burning a tank candle at both ends. I mean, if you don't know English, you don't know English idiom, you really, they took this literally. It really basically is that they have to spread the sheet to show that there was no blood, that comes through the breaking of the hymen. They also interpret the verse, and she shall spit in his face, and this is by Chalitza, he said about the levirate marriage, if decides not to go through the marriage, as she spits in his face. Traditionally means she just spits before him, but it lands on the floor. There they understand it literally. I don't know how many chalitzas they had in those days under their auspice. The sages told them, the sages, in other words, as they were trying to regain control of their courts, it says it is written the Torah and the mitzvah that I've written to guide them. The Torah is the written law, but the mitzvah is the interpretation of that law. You don't know the interpretation. Also written, write for yourself the Shira, this is the song referring to Parshas Hazinu, but it's also referring to the Torah, and study it and place it firmly in your mouth. Which their understanding is, refers to the understanding. In other words, that not only should you know it, but you should understand it. Refers to the halachas, the oral law. The day that it was annulled, that they introduced judges in the legal system that were knowledgeable, and they forbade any judges from using this work, which really automatically disqualified all of those others because they couldn't, they plainly didn't know what to do. The day it was annulled was declared a holiday. This was all done, it would seem, under the auspices of Shimon ben Shetach. But before Shimon ben Shetach was able to reform the entire system, it seems that he first reformed the structure of the Sanhedrin, the great rabbinic high court, which had become the Sadducee High Court. The day that he rid the High Court of the Sadducees, the 28th of Teves was declared a minor holiday. This is again how the Megillus Tainus described what happened. On the 28th of Teves, the assembly, the Sanhedrin, was rightfully constituted. When the Sanhedrin consisted of Sadducees, was in session, together with Yanai, as Alexander, Janaeus, and Salome at his side, there were none of the main body of Israel with them, with the exception of Shimon ben Shetach. They, the king, queen, and Shimon, asked the Sanhedrin various questions dealing with different areas of halacha, but they were not able to cite any sources from the Torah to support their positions. In other words, evidently it would seem Shimon ben Shetach was trying to convince them that you can't have a court of people who know nothing. And they made a special session, they invited all the members of the Sanhedrin, and they were there, and they kept on asking them questions. The thrust, of course, was to show that they know nothing. I mean, it's quite likely, even though Yanai himself was a Sadducee, as he killed his brother, see what kind of his older brother kind of a person it was. It's quite likely that originally their education was a Pharisee education. Remember, the father originally was a Pharisee, and it's quite likely that as a young man he received a traditional Jewish education, even though probably he'd forgotten much of his learning, but at least he himself was able to ask questions. It's quite likely in that sense, even though there could be, maybe the facts are different, if to realize Shimon ben Shetach was of the greatest of the land. It's quite likely, as is most common, he probably had a very traditional education. He went through the Pharisee, you know, educational system. It would be assumed that his sister, Shalom Sin, also had that education. You know, I mean, similar as a girl's education, with the values that Shimon ben Shetach, the parents, held dear. So how did her parents marry her off to Yanai's brother, Aristobulus? He was a Sadducee. And it would seem that the marriage took place before he became a Sadducee. And this is because Yochanan Hyrcanus, the father, was not always a Sadducee. He started off as a Pharisee. His father, Shimon, was a tzaddik, was a saintly person. It seems that Yochanan ben Hyrcanus also started off as a saintly person. And it's quite likely then he educated his children likewise. When he made the break, his whole family made the break, they all became Sadducees. But it's quite likely that Yanai was able to ask questions. He wasn't a total ignoramus. But they were not able to cite any sources from the Torah to support their position. Shimon Shetach said to them, "Anyone who is able to support his view with a proper citation from the Torah is fit to sit on the Sanhedrin. Anyone who cannot is not fit." Once a case came before them that they clearly were unable to resolve by bringing a decisive proof from the Torah. As the Sefer Gezeirosa did not help them. It was a complicated case. They really didn't know the principles involved. One of their elders, however, tried but was challenged by Shimon ben Shetach. The elder said, "Give me time to think it through. By tomorrow I'll answer you." But even after much thought, he was still unable to respond to Shimon ben Shetach. Too embarrassed, he did not show up the next day. Shimon replaced him with one of his disciples. He explained to them that the Sanhedrin must be composed of 71 members, and this scholar, his disciple, was the only suitable replacement. One by one, he was able to eventually replace the whole Sanhedrin. The day that the process was completed was declared a holiday. The task of not only supplying judges for the Sanhedrin HaGadolah, the Supreme Court, but judges for all of the lower courts must have been a major undertaking, especially since Yochanan Hyrcanus had killed out the majority of the rabbinic scholars of the past generation, as we touched upon before. It would seem that Shimon ben Shetach was forced to reorganize a judiciary and appoint, in place of the Sadducee judges, newly trained rabbinic students who probably had very little practical experience in legal affairs. It is with this historical background we can truly appreciate the attention that he and his contemporary Yehuda ben Tabai devoted to ensure that the judiciary would function optimally. It is with this in mind that we can now fully analyze the sayings of Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach. Because they focus on the judiciary because they had to train a whole new generation of judges. And it wasn't just enough to teach them the laws, but they had to direct them. See, in other generations, it wasn't necessary. They would have studied the laws, of course, in the normative yeshiva, and they would have been understudies. They would have interned. But there was no interning here. He got fresh rabbinic students as soon as a vacancy was open, and he got them. So he had to direct them. So these were the directives that he gave them, and that's why in this generation, different than other generations, there was this pressing need to direct them how to be practically how to be judges. We're not dealing with all of the thousands upon thousands of halachas that. That belongs in halacha, and of course they all study that. But this goes into practical, judicial practice. The first of the sayings of Yehuda ben Tabbai was the statement Al tas atzmecho ka'orchei hadayonim. Do not play the part, as it's commonly translated, as an advocate. In modern Hebrew, a lawyer is an orech din. And it's in this sense that the Talmud understands this statement. In other words, don't coach the litigants. Let them tell the story as it is and let the judges judge for themselves. And it tells the Talmud, the Gemara in Ksubas and Beis in 52b, tells over the following story. Rabbi Yochanan was the great scholar and the Talmudic scholar in the time after the period of the Mishnah. As a young man, he had studied under Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and he was the leading figure in the post-Mishnaic period. Rabbi Yochanan's relatives had to maintain their father's wife. In other words, their father had died, she had a widow, and they had to maintain her to support her. And she required daily medical treatment. And there were complaints from Rabbi Yochanan, who was related to them, that it's draining all their resources. When they came to Rabbi Yochanan, he told them, proceed to arrange with a medical man. This is an inclusive fee. In other words, arranged, it's like an HMO. In other words, give him one flat fee, you'll treat him. You see, everything is in the Torah. Later, however, Rabbi Yochanan remarked, we have put ourselves in the unenviable position of being an Aruch Din, of being legal advisors. I should have never given them the advice. You know, why should I favor one party over another? I shouldn't have got involved. If they have a question, they should go to a judge who is dispassionate. In other words, I'm giving one party an advantage over the other party. What, however, the Talmud asked, was his opinion at first. And after he gave the advice, he had regrets. But originally, he was aware of this Mishnah. What brought him to originally give the advice? Why did he change it at the end? At first he thought, the Gemara says, of the scriptural text. It's in Isaiah 58:7. That you should not hide yourself from your own flesh. Because you have to help your relatives. You know, there has to be a sense that relatives have to help each other. But ultimately, afterwards, Rabbi Yochanan realized that it's true, perhaps another person would be allowed to do this. Because it isn't the question. The question more so is, you're having an... why are you picking sides? You're giving the other person an unfair advantage. But families have to stick together. But he regretted it because he's an Odom Choshev. A noted personality is different from the general public. Because if they, a person who has a high profile, if they see him do something which technically is correct, but for other people would not be correct. People don't realize the subtleties, and we'll expand on this, we'll extrapolate. And a person who's a public persona should not do things which are technically correct, but may lead to situations that are not correct. But Al Kaponim, you see from this citation in Ksubas that the interpretation of Orech Din is being an advocate. One should not be an advocate for one of the two sides. There's a similar idea was expressed in the Talmud Yerushalmi in Ksubas. This is in chapter 4, Halacha 10, Dalet Yud. Rabbi Chagai, in the name of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, said, implied in the statement, Al tas atzmecho korcha dayonim, is do not play the part of an advocate. Means that you should not reveal to an individual the laws that applies to his case. Don't tell him, let the judge who's impartial tell everything. Just don't go and take the initiative and inform him, giving him an unfair advantage over the other party. Let them both come in front of the judge. Let the judge inform both of them together. as is. You've given one person information, the other is lacking that information, and it skews the judgment process. That's one interpretation of Al Tas Asmach HaKorcha Deyonim. It seems Ovis the Rabbi Nosson has a different interpretation of that statement. And they seem to interpret this in terms of the Orcha Dayanim is referred to as a secular judge. Arkos is a secular court. You Jewish judges should be careful to judge in the Jewish tradition and don't try to copy the non-Jewish model. You know, no gavels in the court. No, I'm just joking. Yeah. We derive from this teaching, Al Tas Atzmecha Korcha Deyonim, don't play the part of a secular judge. If you enter a study hall, a Beis Medrash, and hear something or a halachic statement, it says you shouldn't become excited and immediately respond. Don't shoot from the hip. Because evidently he was saying that's included in the idea of Orcha Deyonim. Don't model yourself after them. But rather you should sit and inquire into the reason why the person made the statement, into the details of the background of the questionable case or halacha. In other words, don't make any assumptions. This is similar to having Mesunim Badin. This be deliberate in judgment. But here he's telling this new generation of judges that don't, whose model, they haven't seen any model. They've seen Sadducees, or they've seen non-Jewish judges. So he told them, says, don't follow that model. Because there's a Jewish model. It may take more time. It takes more investigation, but that's the Jewish model. There's another part in this, it seems, in Avraham Nosson. So one is the approach the judge takes. As it should be done with deliberation. There's another part of this, it should be done, the judgment should be equitable. As in both parties should be heard equally. And each party should feel that they had their day in court, so to speak. That they were able to express themselves completely and clearly. When two litigants come before you to be judged, one of them poor and the other rich, you shouldn't say, how can I declare the poor man innocent and the rich man guilty? In other words, this is a mechubadika person, he's an honored person. And therefore you'll skew the judgment because you feel it's true, it wasn't right, but there are other higher reasons why you did it. Your job is to be a judge and to judge fairly and to say the truth. And evidently these were things that secular judges would do. Or how can I declare the rich man innocent and the poor man guilty? He's such a poor man. Even though the truth is that poor man is guilty. That poor man should pay. But you'll change the judgment because you feel because of social concerns. That's not the role of a Jewish judge. You have to say who is innocent is innocent, guilty is guilty. You may say, if I condemn the poor man, and the poor man will be my enemy. And if I declare the poor, if I condemn the poor man, he'll be my enemy. And if I declare the poor man to be innocent, the wealthy man will be my enemy. You know, so I should worry about, like, who am I worse off? He's my enemy. That shouldn't be your concern. And don't say, how can I take money from this party and give it to the other party? The Torah says, don't favor anyone in judgment. Rav Meir used to say, what is the meaning of the verse? You shall hear the small as well as the great. It means you should not let one of the litigants stand while the other is sitting. In other words, referring to the small person, you know, versus kikotn kigodl tishmon, is not referring to small cases versus large cases, but a person of stature, of high stature versus low stature. Listen to both of them. Don't favor one of them. Don't let one stand, the other sit. The one who adequately articulate his position while you tell the other one, make your remarks brief. You know, I don't have all day here. Rabbi Huda said, I heard that if you want to make both of them sit, then it's fine. even though normally they should stand in front of the judge. If he wants to sit them, it's fine. What is forbidden to let one of them sit and to let the other stand? Because the person who is not given the preferred treatment feels he doesn't have a case anyway. Whatever he says, the judge is biased in favor of the other party, and therefore he will not articulate his case well. Another interpretation of the verse, you shall hear the small is the great, means you should treat a small case like a large case. A case involving only a pruta, only a penny, treated like a judgment involving 100 mona, means 10,000 dinorim. This, the Talmud says in Sanhedrin Daf Ches, is referring to the fact that we have two cases on the docket. It's first come, first serve. The one who registers first gets it. Even though it may be a small, minor case, he came first, he gets it. That should not sway. The amount of money does not determine preference. Okay, this is the ideas expressed in the Orchai de Yonim. Of course, we went through the other part of Yehuda ben Tabai's statement. When the parties in the lawsuit are standing before, you should view them both as being guilty. Just think the worst of them, because you'll be attentive to the subtleties in there and what they say, and you'll pick up perhaps a falsehood or contradiction. Besides this saying, he had a very also the officer of Nosson preserves another very interesting and important saying. He used to say, Yehuda ben Tabai, before I took a position of leadership, if anyone would suggest that I take such a position, I would have been so offended I would have attempted to deprive him of his very livelihood. Because I wanted to be a private person, I didn't want to be a public person. Now that I have taken such a position of leadership, if anyone would suggest to me to relinquish my position, I would entertain the desire to pour over his head a boiling kettle of water. For it is difficult to take upon oneself an exalted position, and just as difficult to relinquish it. A case in point is Saul, Shaul HaMelech, who at first, when he was offered the throne, was hiding, as it is said in Scripture. This is in the first book of Samuel 10:22. Behold, he has hidden himself amongst the baggage. His nechbel akelim. He's hiding amongst the baggage. But later, when they told him to relinquish the throne, he sought to kill David HaMelech. This is very often you find in communal life, that there is a situation that you feel someone who has a position of leadership is no longer fit for that position. Sometimes they originally were, but times have changed, they've changed. It's extremely difficult to remove someone from office. And perhaps he's telling us that in the idea of a judiciary, and they had appointed all these new rabbinic appointments, down the line there are going to be people that you feel that you may have appointed the wrong people to the job. Or says that they were originally good, effective, and now they should be in a position of being of emeritus. You should know how difficult it is and how thoroughly embarrassing it is for the person who will be deprived of his position, and how he will fight like a lion to preserve that position. It's important to know this. A person is naive in public life, and you figure, listen, the person himself realizes he's lived beyond his usefulness, he should just step down. That, unfortunately, is not the case, and you should be aware of this. And it has tremendous application in day-to-day life. This is an Ovis to Rabbi Nosson. Now, this is an additional teaching of in other words, Yehuda ben Tabai must have said 10,000 things. All of us only preserve these three things because they were probably the most often repeated. They felt that they were the most important for all generations. But they're giving us another, an additional insight. Now I'd like to discuss the teaching of Shimon ben Shetach. And the Ovis Rabbi Nosson clearly says is while you're interrogating them, as Harbi Lachkoris Adam, you should interrogate them thoroughly. Be careful with the words you choose, lest they listen carefully to the manner in which you express yourself, only make more false statements, for they may well be very sharp charlatans. So you have to be very careful. And again, this is advice to the judiciary. I'd like to share with you now a story which Rashi, which is based on the Talmud Yerushalmi, which Rashi preserves in his commentary in Sanhedrin Mem Dalet Amud Beis in 44b. I won't burden you with the Hebrew, but I'll translate as I'm reading here. There was an incident with a Jewish tax collector who was an evil person and died. That very same day that he died, one of the most prestigious, greatest people of the city, a Talmud Chacham, a Tzaddik, also died. The entire city came to pay homage to this great man who died. Those who were involved in the burial of this tax collector, who was probably universally hated, I mean, the tax collectors farm taxes. It wasn't an equitable system that's predictable. They would gouge the public, and they were viewed as thieves. So the only ones involved in the funeral of this tax collector was his immediate family. As you had this small procession of the tax collector, the very large procession of the scholar, the saint, as they are going together to the graveyard, they were attacked by enemies. They dropped the caskets. They either had to flee or fight against the enemy. After the danger had passed, they had fled. They came back. They made a mistake. They switched caskets. There had been one disciple of that scholar who had stayed nearby and was able to identify. Evidently, they were virtual caskets. And he would describe, this is my Rebbe. No one would listen to him. No, that's the one. We know for sure. It didn't help. And he was screaming. So it came out that the relatives of tax collector buried the scholar in a very humble ceremony. And this tax collector got Kovod Malachim, got the great honors. This disciple was very bothered by this. How is it came out the tax collector got all the Kovod? They're all crying and has paid him the eulogies you can imagine the sight, and this Talmud Chacham is buried just if they had a minion. So he was bothered. What did he sin? In other words, what did he do to deserve such a degrading burial? Because when he was buried, they thought he was the evil man, and on the contrary, this tax collector got this tremendous honor. The scholar appeared to his student in a dream and told him, "Don't worry, let me show you the honor that's given to me in Gan Eden, in paradise, and I'll show you how that evil man is suffering." And the way it's described, and I'm sure it's an allegory, but it's as if it's viewed as if Gehenna has a door. Now there's again from. So there's a door, and they used to. We have hinges in our doors. Hinges are on the side on the doorposts. In antiquity, the how doors would swing, there would be protrusion from the bottom of the door. They're next to the doorpost. You know, very often you find in sliding, you know, in closet doors, in little closet doors, that they swing on, you know, on these two things that protrude. You know, so that's how it used to be. And that's called the tzir. So this, the ear of this man, this evil man, is the doorpost, is the hole is in his ear. So when the doors of Gehenna, hell, keep on swinging back and forth, they're swinging, you know, in his ear. Again, it's an allegory, but whatever it is, it's not geshmak, and this is not good. So why is it that good? So ultimately, the saint thrived, the sinner got his, but why was it in that sole incident that that he suffered so much? I mean, at least the degradation. He says, one time I heard someone make a disparaging remark about scholars, Talmid HaChacham, and I didn't protest. And that's why I was punished. Yeah, I was silent while the scholars were disparaged, and I should have stood up, taken their cause, and that's why I was punished. It was a short period, but that was my punishment. And why did that tax collector tell you the story? One time, he had made a great banquet for the mayor of the city. And the mayor didn't show, and he had all this extra food. And he distributed it to the poor. So for that one incident, he was paid back. And this was his reward. But God rewards everything, but that's it. There's nothing left. So this student asked his teacher in a dream, how long is this man condemned that the door of Gehenna should swing on his ear? So he says, he'll be there until Shimon ben Shetach dies and he'll take his place. So he said, Shimon ben Shetach, what happened? So there are women who practice witchcraft. They're Jewish women. They're in Ashkelon. And he doesn't do anything with them. He lets them practice. And therefore he is considered, despite all of his learning and all of his greatness, the fact is he has the power to do something and doesn't. He is held accountable. The next day, the one who had the dream told the story to Shimon ben Shetach. So what did Shimon ben Shetach do? He gathered 80 young men, Bochrim, of stature, Balikaim, and that day was a rainy day. One day our kids brought back a book from the library, a kid's book on this story, this part of the story, not the first part. And they gave each one of them a large earthenware barrel, jug. And they each one folded a talus in these jugs. So there was, you see the scene, there's this large jug, this large can of earthenware. That a talus was stuck inside, and there was the lid was put on top. And he told them, says, now we're going. Evidently, they went to Ashkelon, or they were prepared before. They went by the entrance of this coven, you know, this witch's. And he told them, you know, and it's raining outside. They're getting pretty wet. He says, be careful. He says, there are 80 witches. And he picked, there were 80 bochrim. There's 80 young men. And the time when you're going to come into that, to the witch's den, the coven, says, you lift each one, pick someone, lift them up off the ground. When they're not connected to the ground, they cannot practice their sorcery. It's like electricity. You have to be grounded, you know. That's what, you know, you see the birds, you know, they can go on these electric wires. It doesn't flow through them. Says, evidently, they have to be grounded. And if not, if you keep them on the ground, you won't do anything. They'll be able to extricate themselves. So Shimon ben Shetach comes in to their great hall, and he left the bochrim outside. They're still wet. And he told them, they said, who are you? He says, Mechashef ani, I'm a master sorcerer. And I want to test you. It says like this. It says, I want to test you in sorcery. See, I want to see your mettle. So he says, how do I know you're a sorcerer? What can you do? He says, I'll tell you what I'll do. I can bring, you know, at the snap of a finger, I'll bring you 80 young men, all wearing talasim, and that they're all dry. It's a rainy day. He says, that's my trick. So let's say, okay, let's see it. So he hinted to them, whatever, he gave a high sign. They immediately took out their talasim, you know, from these earthenware containers. They put them on and entered, and they looked pretty good. I mean, they didn't take a look what was below, I guess, but they looked pretty good. So they were shocked, and as they were looking, each one of them picked up one of the witches. And once they were picked up, they couldn't do anything. They took them out to be tried, and they were all hanged. As they brought witnesses, they were all hanged. And they're hanged, and they're stoned to death. After the expression, tolui is after they're stoned to death, and therefore they, afterwards, for a brief moment before burial, their dead body is lifted up on a wooden scaffold, that they're viewed, taken down, and buried. The relatives, you know, they were Jewish women. They had relatives. They were not too happy to see that all of their relatives being killed. Two of them went and devised a strategy and invented a story. And they gave testimony against the son of Shimon ben Shetach that he had done a violation of a capital crime. And they were witnesses. They had given him warning. And they actually had their so well versed that they could not be tripped. They didn't trip them up. And when the son was going out to be stoned, he said, the son made the following declaration, the Shimon Shetach's son. If I am guilty of this, my death should not be an atonement for this sin. But it's not so, which I claim I'm innocent, my death should be an atonement for all of my other sins, minor sins I've done. However, the judgment, like the chains, that will be on the necks of the witnesses. They are the ones who will ultimately suffer for this. That was his statement. It was basically, I'm innocent. I tell you I'm so innocent, says that if I am guilty, I should be condemned not only in this world and the next world too. This death should not be an atonement for my sins. But if I am innocent, this death should be atoned not for that sin which is a lie, which is a falsehood, but from all my other sins. But these people, they're going to suffer. When the people who were there heard this, they retracted. And they said why they had concocted this whole story. And it was because of the hatred, because of these women who had been killed. They were related to them. Even so, there's a halacha, a witness cannot retract his testimony. And Shimon ben Shetach's son was put to death. And commentaries comment, the idea of being careful to cross-examine the witnesses was something that was part of Shimon ben Shetach's own experience of the importance to do so. And perhaps if they had been more careful, perhaps they would have caught the lie. But he was part of this. Shimon ben Shetach is known, besides recreating the judiciary, but he recreated the whole educational system in Eretz Yisrael. Again, you can imagine after Yochanan Hyrcanus and after Aristobulus and Yanai, there was a major problem. How the Pharisees had been killed, and he reconstructed the whole system. It's interesting to note, and we'll read now, we'll conclude with a passage from Josephus in the Talmud, that the time that Shimon ben Shetach where his influence was mostly felt, was the most prosperous time in the Second Temple period. Yanai HaMelech, we went through, we have on tape, it was one of our early lectures about Yanai HaMelech and Shimon ben Shetach. But when he died, he put the reins of power, Yanai put, in his wife, Salome. Shalom Tzion. Shalom Tzion. And she would seem, together with Shimon ben Shetach, led the country in a way which was unequaled either before or afterwards. Of course, the Sadducees were not happy about the situation. But the fact was, it was an era of unprecedented peace. And I'd like to read to you from Josephus how he describes the period. It begins right after Yanai dies. So Alexandra, her name was Salome Alexandra, and his name Yanai was Alexander Yanai. So it was Alexander and Alexandra. When she had taken the fortress, acted as her husband had suggested to her, and spoke to the Pharisees, and put all things into their power. She empowered the Pharisees, both as to the dead body, as to the affairs of the kingdom, and thereby pacified their anger against Alexander, because we had described how Shimon ben Shetach had restored the judiciary. Sometime afterwards, though, he fell out with Shimon ben Shetach. There was a civil war that was made to try to displace Yanai. He again killed Pharisees. There's terrible stories with him. That's why when he died, there was tremendous anger against him. But she pacified this anger and made them bear goodwill and friendship to him. When they came among the multitude and made speeches to them and laid before them the actions of Alexander and told them they had lost the righteous king, and by the commendation they gave him, as they saw themselves, they had to make... To stop the civil war, to make amends. She told them, you'll have all the power. And they made a whole public ceremony, really as a sign of peace. And they brought them to grieve, those are the Sadducees, and to be in heaviness for him, so that he had a funeral more splendid than had any of the kings before him. Alexander left behind him two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. Was their mother was the Shlomz, Alexandra, but committed the kingdom to Alexandra. Now as to these sons, Hyrcanus was indeed unable to manage public affairs and delighted rather in a quiet life. But the younger, Aristobulus, was an active and bold man. For this woman herself, Alexandra, she was loved by the multitude because she seemed displeased at the offenses her husband had been guilty of. It's interesting how, right, so she seemed displeased. See, the source of his history are from Sadducees. This is not a Pharisee history of the period. This is a Sadducee history. And it continues, so she made Hyrcanus high priest, because he was the elder, but much more because he cared not to meddle with politics and permitted the Pharisees to do everything, to whom she also ordered the multitude to be obedient. She also restored again those practices which the Pharisees had introduced, according to the traditions of their forefathers, and which her father-in-law Hyrcanus had abrogated. So she had indeed the name of the regent, but the Pharisees had the authority, for it was they who restored such as had been banished, I guess the Pharisees that had been, been forced to flee, and set such as were prisoners at liberty, and this, the Pharisees who had been in prison. And to say all at once, they differed in nothing from lords, as they became the lords, the rulers. Again, you see the bitterness this is written is definitely not written by a sympathizer of Pharisees. However, the queen also took care of the affairs of the kingdom and got together a great body of mercenary soldiers and increased her own army to such a degree that she became terrible to the neighboring tyrants and took hostages of them, and the country was entirely at peace. This was unequaled during the entire second period, temple period. The Talmud describes the blessings that occurred. Evidently, was a time of tremendous Torah learning. In the days of Shimon ben Shetach, the Gemara in Tinus and Chov Gimel Amud Aleph in 23a states, the rains fell only on Wednesday nights and Shabbos nights, in times people normally stay indoors. The wheat grains grew as large as kidneys, barley grains as large as olive pits, and lentils as large as gold coins. They wrapped them to preserve them as a sign for all generations to show how sin can affect potential blessing. We will continue on, Mr. Hashem, next week into the period after the death, this peaceful period, the death of Salome. It ushered in a terrible civil war, famine, and it ushered in Roman rule. And all of this, of course, and much more will be the subject of the coming lecture. Are there any questions? He had all told, he had five sons. He had first, Aristobulus was the oldest, I think Antigonus was next, and Yanai was next. And there were two others. No. She first married Aristobulus died. Yanai. Yeah, so their first son they named Hyrcanus, after the deceased, you know, his father. And the second son they named Aristobulus after this deceased, or first husband, deceased brother of Yanai. Even though it's interesting, even though this Aristobulus had Yanai imprisoned. The first Aristobulus had Yanai imprisoned. I still don't have a name. So there's a it's not clear. It seems as if you're just offering your advice and you're interfering, don't interfere. A regular Beis Din, though, they do have a practice of, you know, having a Tohen, which is an Orech Din, but both have them equally. And they are both a function of the court. But a regular person, though, and a disinterested party should not get involved and try to, in litigation and trying to coach one of the litigants. Let the judge himself hear both sides of the story. He'll ask the questions, he'll bring out the points, and leave it to him. It would seem so, unless that there is a system that both, you know, both are seeking legal advice, probably, then it's equal. It would seem from this is your question, it would seem so. We're assuming a judiciary that functions well as a judiciary, you know. So the question was, why didn't they, you know, the story of Shimon ben Shetach's son, that the witnesses recanted, so why didn't they reverse the decision? Witnesses are not allowed to recant. Because evidently there's a halacha. Evidently there's always the fear, probably. It is a halacha from the Torah, that you give the testimony and that's it. I mean, in all probability, we get a situation that you have witnesses in the court. They will condemn someone, and by gunpoint, afterwards, people will say, "says we'll kill your wife and children if you don't recant." So therefore, we don't believe them, as we only accept the first testimony, and that's that. unless there would be witnesses to contradict them. You know, we have other witnesses. Okay, give other witnesses, but they couldn't find other witnesses. If there had been other witnesses, those other witnesses could be brought. We were with the party and we saw it did not occur. Or we were with the witnesses at that time, they said, and they were not at that place and they could have never seen it. That's the means that the original testimony could be overturned, because you have contradictory testimony. But if there's no other testimony, it's they themselves, the testimony they give is final. Yeah, the question is about normally halacha we hold that you need hasra, you need a warning. If you do need warning, where was the warning? Two things. First of all, actually, there's an argument. Even though we rule that you do need warning, there's an opinion. Rabbi Yehuda maintains that if the people themselves are knowledgeable of the law and fully aware of the consequences of what they're doing, they do not need a warning. It's possible Shimon ben Shetach is of that opinion. There's a whole question what Shimon ben Shetach's opinion is. But even if he was of the other opinion, which is the halacha, the majority opinion, that you do need a formal warning, it's quite possible that when Shimon ben Shetach began this, he had already inquired, he had witnesses. And it could be that a year ago, or 2 years ago, or 5 years ago, these women had done this. Witnesses had warned them, you'll be taken to the courts. They laughed, you know, no one would have the courage to take us to the courts. You know, and ha-ha, and you know, and they went along their witches. Maybe zapped them, I don't know what they did. But they, yeah. All these witnesses recovered, whatever, but they came to the court, and they came and gave the testimony, okay? Good to meet you, Hashem. We'll see you next week.